What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to episode 518 with my guest, Gabby Lamb. I'm Paul Gilmartin. This is Mental Illness Happy Hour, a place for honesty about all the bullshit in our heads. I'm not a therapist. This is not a doctor's office. It's more like a waiting room that doesn't suck. The website for this show is mentalpod.com. Go there. Fill out a survey. It's anonymous. Maybe browse the forum. Find some like-minded people. You can also support the show through the website. You can do donations through PayPal or Patreon. We also accept Zelle, and we can always use contributions. So just putting that out there. Oh, you can also buy t-shirts and coffee mugs and stuff like that. How are you holding up? How is the fall depression? I'm so jealous of people people that don't experience depression, but especially people who don't experience the onslaught of fall depression. I have been sleeping more than I've been awake. I might sleep more than dead people. I could be wrong. I've never talked to any, but, I'm trying not to judge myself. It is what it is. And, it's at least I'm not putting any gas on the fire by judging myself for it. And, I know the worm will turn. This is from the racism survey filled out by Carmen, and she is American Indian, and she writes, I have too many experiences with racism to count. I cannot pick more than one race on the survey question, but I am biracial. I am Native American and Latina. People are constantly fascinated when they learn I am Native American and expect me to know something about other tribes they've heard of. Or they say that they're part Native too. There's a difference between having Native American ancestry and being involved in the culture and the community of your tribe. I always say people have negative assumptions and feelings about Natives until they want to be one to seem cool or exotic. To remember how you felt when you experienced racism. When I encounter racism, I always feel defensive and confused at first. Then I feel angry. Ultimately, I feel at peace with the experience. It isn't the first time I've dealt with racism, and it won't be the last. Might as well make a joke out of it or come to terms with who that person truly is. How do you feel about those experiences now? I feel supported. My family, my friends, my boyfriend are all very understanding to my experiences and have stood up for me before in the face of a racist. Any thoughts or feelings you'd like to share? Just that I would have liked to check both my races in this survey. I feel very uncomfortable on surveys when I feel I have to ignore one half of myself for convenience sake. First of all, thank you for your survey, and I have remedied that by including another box for people to, if they are mixed, to specify what. I get so nervous when I talk about race. I'm so afraid that I'm going to say something that sounds insensitive or... This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a guy who calls himself, if it's a cunt, call it a cunt. He writes, it's days like this. I'm almost prepared to forgive my old man for blowing his own brains out on my birthday a while back. I worked for cunts. I married a cunt. Most of my extended family are cunts. Just about anyone I considered a friend a dozen years ago has disappeared because, well, they are obviously super cunty. No wonder the old man wanted out of this fucking world. I debated whether or not to read this one, and ultimately I decided I wanted to because... One, first of all, you sound like you're in a lot of pain and you got a lot of anger and you're feeling really alone. And I'm sorry that you're experiencing that. And if I can just share some of my experience when I have felt isolated and angry, one of the things that opened the door for me was to say, what is the common denominator in all of these difficult relationships I have with people? And the common denominator was me. And I had to take a good look at myself. And that's not to say there aren't times when somebody was just toxic and I needed to cut them out of my life and I hadn't done anything wrong. But many, many times I was contributing to that dynamic. And you honestly, you sound like you got a lot of really negative, hostile energy coming out of you. And that's got to be difficult for other people. So, you know, it might help to take a look at your part, to take a look at the way that you're behaving and how other people might experience you. And, you know, it's scary to fucking go into what is underneath the anger, because that's the gold in finding out what's going on underneath there. Because in my opinion, anger is never just about anger. It's about what's underneath it. Frustration, sadness, grief, loneliness, all kinds of stuff. So just putting that out there and sending you some love and good vibes. We are sponsored today, as always, by the online therapy provider BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. If you are interested in checking out online therapy, and you know, let's be honest, is there a better time to try it than right now? But I've been using it for years, and I love the relationship I have with my therapist, Donna. So if you want to check it out, go to BetterHelp.com/mental. Make sure you include the slash mental so they know you came from this podcast. And then just fill out a questionnaire. And if they have a counselor they think is a good match for you, they'll pair you up with one and you can experience a free week of counseling to see if it's a good fit for you. And they are licensed in all 50 states and they have a huge pool of counselors to choose from. But occasionally they will say, you know, this is a situation where I think you need to find somebody in person. Who has very, very specific expertise that we don't have available right now. BetterHelp.com/mental. And one more survey before we get to the interview with Gabby. Yeah. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by a guy who calls himself Guy Incognito. And he writes, when grandma showed me the photo albums she kept over the years, this picture is of our old farm. It had a crawl space underneath. When your grandpa lost his mind, that's where I hid the guns. Then she turned the page and talked about a dog they once had.
Every little thing feels like the end of the world. The darkness came so quickly.
I was so fucking angry.
Make me as close to dead as possible.
And I felt so powerless.
Without the commitment.
If there's a word for it,
unbearable.
It means somebody else felt this way.
The feeling is so intense.
It is a lot more work.
I was frightened all the time.
To feed a child's emotional world.
Everyone feels pain.
Than it is their superficial world.
Everyone suffers.
My sexual addiction was the shame.
My mom ended up killing that woman in front of me and my brothers.
I had to feel that shame in order to feel the pleasure.
And I was being a dick to everybody.
We are social beings.
And the only way you're going to get it out is to cry.
We need to be with people.
I grabbed them by their throats and led them down to the floor and watched the breath leave their bodies.
Maybe well, listen, thanks for coming in. I am here with Gabby Lamb, who you may know as a stand-up comedian, an actress. You've got a big presence on Instagram. You do some really, really funny stuff on there. You put questions out to your followers. I was watching one of the most recent ones where you put out questions about people's fetishes or family secrets and stuff like that. And, yeah, I went, somebody suggested you as a guest for the podcast. I can't remember who it was, but I watched 2 seconds of your Instagram stuff and I'm like, oh yeah. I can see why. You are a sober person. You've been sober almost a year.
Almost a year. A year in January.
Kudos.
Thank you.
Kudos.
Thank you.
And you also kind of hinted on your account that you go to support groups for intimacy issues as well.
Yeah.
Attraction to unavailable guys.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Where do we begin?
I know. Where do we unpack?
Yes. Well, let's talk about what was childhood like? What were you like as a kid? Give me some snapshots, some memories that you think are kind of representative of little Gabby's childhood.
You know, it all starts with childhood, doesn't it? It really, everything
really does.
The older I get to, the more I'm like, oh, this is all childhood. Everything. You like trying to undo everything that you like went through in your weird formative years.
And the good news is, though, is it is undoable.
It
a
is,
lot of
yeah.
it. The brain really, yeah. it does have a lot of plasticity to it.
It does.
It's just a fucking pain in the ass.
It's endless work.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of work, a lot of faith.
Yeah, it is. And the more, it's like the more work you do, the more starts to unravel where you're like, oh, I thought I could have been done, but no, there's
no finish line.
There's no finish line.
But there's rewards along the way, yeah, which is cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah. It is the curse of being self-aware. Once you get there, it's like you can't not be there anymore.
You can't. You can't not know that there's so much you don't know.
Yeah, right. I'm like so... Sorry, I'm getting off the topic, but I'm so jealous of people that don't have a lot of self-awareness to an extent, because I'm like, it must be nice to just live in this like blissful ignorance.
Yeah. But are they blissful?
Yeah, I don't
hope
know.
They're not.
I know, right?
I hope they're miserable.
I know, because I am.
No, I wish them all the best, but the jealous part of me is like, you don't have to go to support group meetings and take meds and
function.
Talk to a therapist and journal and pray and meditate and stretch and
God, it's endless.
Self-reflect and...
Right. Right. It's fucking endless. Bad childhood. What was childhood like? You know, I think I had a pretty good...
Where were you raised?
I was born in LA and raised, I think we moved to San Diego or Oceanside when I was 5. Mm-hmm. So raised in Oceanside, which is like, you know, 45 minutes north of San Diego.
Yeah, but I've been there. Mm-hmm. Did stand up. They used to have a club there outside the military base.
Did they?
Yeah, yeah. And my best friend lives in Carlsbad, so made many, many trips down there.
Yep. Carlsbad is a neighboring city.
Yeah,
but that's where I grew up. My childhood was pretty. It was. I don't know what to compare it to because I haven't lived anybody else's childhood, but I think it was. My parents are really interesting. They have a very interesting dynamic as far as like. How I grew up, it was not, what's the word I'm looking for? It wasn't super conventional, but I grew up in like a very pretty nice house at the time. It was a really nice house, like really close to the beach. My dad's an artist who never had a as far as I've been alive, he hasn't really had a job. And not because he made a bunch of money off of art, just because he's like a lazy artist.
Right. So your mom kind of...
Yeah, my mom's a teacher, so she was the one. She worked in film before, like right when I was born, up until I was about five, and then when she moved to San Diego, she became a teacher.
Okay.
She's always been like the breadwinner, and my dad's kind of been like the...
I watched one of your Instagram posts, and it was you in your mom's kitchen going through about what looked like 500 corks, wine bottle corks
That's
that she
so
had saved.
Funny. Yeah, she does do that. She's done that my entire life, where she does this thing where she like hoards corks and plastic bags from grocery stores. It's like she'll like put bags and bags and bags and bags and drawers full of corks.
Yeah.
And that she's kind of a weird hoarder in like we've always had like a lot of stuff in the cupboards, like expired food and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime I'd want to throw something out, she'd be like, no, let's keep it. And I'd be like, that expired in 1996. It's 2011. And she's like, no, it's probably still good.
We'll eat it on its centennial.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
She kind of made mention that she drinks a lot.
She does. She's a bottle of wine or a night kind of person.
Was that ever an issue? Or do you think it's become an issue for her or your relationship with her?
You know, I didn't really realize that it was. I mean, because growing up, I was like, oh, that's just like a normal thing.
Right.
You know, like moms get fucked up off wine and that's what they do. They smoke inside and they cuss and they drink a bunch of wine. And that's just like...
Silently wish their husbands would work.
Oh, yeah. Oh, silently. God, she was fucking loud about it.
To you or to him?
To everyone. Like, to me, yeah. God, it was like... that was like their constant fight, which was were always happening in front of me. It was like, why did you get a fucking job, John? I'm the only one who fucking works. Kind of... that was like the vibe of the house.
Right.
But like, it was very chaotic in a lot of ways, but I feel like I did have very good parents. They're two very different people that love me very much. But my mom was like raised by, like her dad was from Egypt. He was a super like not emotional guy. He had a lot of his own fucking weird issues. And I don't think he was a pretty like verbally abusive guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so she has like a lot of shit. And then my dad has his own trauma. And so I just like, as I've gotten older, I'm like, oh, I'm like unpacking all of your guys' trauma.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, we're unpacking our great grandparents' shit.
No, it's ancestral. It just goes and goes and goes.
Yeah.
It goes and goes and goes. But yeah, like it was a very comfortable upbringing for sure. It was just now that I'm older, I see like where my issues with like chaotic relationships come from and like my low self-esteem, like how that all came from them. And I do have a lot of issues with like my mom and dad that I have to work out.
Anything you're comfortable talking about?
With the issues that I have to work out?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely. But all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are some that spring to mind, the ones that you feel like are going to require the heaviest lifting in recovery?
Honestly.
Or therapy?
They're so fucking... I've been in therapy for 8 years, and I literally just feel like I've started, like, scratching the surface of it, which is wild, because, like, my therapist for so long was like, you need to get sober, you need to be in, you know, intimacy programs, and for so long, I was like, no, like, I'm fine, or maybe you're right, but, like, I don't... You know,
I'll go when it gets bad.
Right. And then she would say, like, well, you literally you're paying me to tell you to go to free programs. And right. I was like, but I would rather just pay you. I don't want to have to do the extra work. And she was like, okay, well, I'll just watch you unravel. And she sure did. But like, you know, the things that come to mind first, I suppose, with like mending relationships with parents is like, I become like really aware of attachment style stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's like because it's such like a topic now, because like everybody now, I feel like it's such a thing in like social psychology to like be aware of what your attachment style is, you know?
Right.
And so now I'm like always thinking about that and how I have very intense like emotional... I didn't realize that I was also a very emotionally unavailable person, And I started realizing, like, oh, emotional unavailability attracts emotional unavailability.
Yeah, it's catnip.
It
because
is.
You know they're not going to get too close.
Right.
And there's something safe in that.
Exactly. And that's the that's the stuff that I have to unpack with, like, the familial stuff, where it's like that chaotic attachment style of, like, oh, but I'm used to feeling, like, on edge, and I'm used to feeling like things are going to fall apart, and I'm used to feeling like somebody's going to yell at me or, like, not be proud of me, you know?
Yeah.
And so I, like, unintentionally am drawn to that over and over again.
Isn't it weird how, like, before we begin to recover, if we have intimacy issues, the being attracted to unavailable people, when we come across somebody who is available and is fairly healthy and wants to be in a relationship, yeah, we either look at them like they're making our skin crawl or they bore the fuck out of us.
Crazy. Yeah. My therapist always tells me that. She's like, you're going to be, you need to be with somebody who is going to bore you, who isn't going to, like, keep you chaotically going. And I'm like, no, bitch, you're fucking wrong. But she's right. And the person that I'm dating now is like, and I, like, shouldn't, I honestly, like, shouldn't be, my therapist forever was like, you shouldn't be dating, like, give yourself a year. And I gave myself, like, 6 months, and I was like, I'm ready to date again. But, like, I'm working through it. The person that I'm involved with right now is, like, very the opposite of, like, what I go for, you know, where it's like chaos. Like, he's very mellow. It's like a very easy relationship. And so I feel myself being like, okay, where can I start stirring up the drama?
Right.
Where can I fuck this up? And it's like been a big learning lesson with him.
Have you had moments like that where you've started to throw some, give me some examples of you starting a shit storm or thinking you want one?
Right. I, you know, it, like, the beginning of our relationship, it's fairly new, but the beginning of it was very chaotic on my end, where I was like, I would do the thing where I would be, like, pulled away emotionally and not really be available and not be able to really make up my mind. And then I don't know how to, like, say, I was not being emotionally available.
Would you find yourself, like, physically shutting down, getting tired?
Yes.
Yeah. Isn't that a weird thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's our body's old way of trying to protect us. I think when shit was too heavy as kids, we would just retreat into ourselves.
Dissociate
and shut, yeah,
yeah.
And shut down, because I will find myself sometimes if I'm at a party or even if I'm with somebody I love, sometimes there's, like, something in me that clicks off and I have to go to bed.
Yeah. That's so interesting that you bring that up, because so in this current relationship, I feel myself doing that a lot now, even, like, physically, like, I shut down and I'm like, I just would rather, you know, like, not be intimate or just, like, not at all. And I'm like, this isn't, like, usually how I am. But, you know, in my previous relationships, they've been so fucking, like, sexually chaotic that my body, you know, like, craves it. Cause I'm like, I need to know when it's going to be.
Right.
It's so, because, like, nutty.
Is that because the sex was about things other than intimacy and pleasure? They were about validation.
Yes, absolutely. About, like,
reassurance.
Yes. Having sex with people just to, like, make sure that they would stay interested in me.
Control.
Yeah, absolutely.
Manipulation.
Yes. And I'm, like, realizing so much now how much of me is, like, how much I'm identifying with being, like, a control freak, and how I do use sex as, like, a tool of manipulation.
Yeah.
And I'm like discovering a lot of that too in this current relationship that's actually healthy, because I'm like, oh, all the old tricks aren't what I'm going to anymore. And, like, it's like changing my brain in a way where I'm seeing things differently. But yeah,
have you experienced intimacy with your partner where it doesn't go sexual? It's still physically intimate, but it doesn't go sexual. It's just like you just lay on the couch and, you know, rest your heads against each other, or, you know, do just affectionate things.
Yeah.
And how have you found that?
There's a lot of that now, and I'm having a lot more of that now than I've ever actually really had. And it's really nice, because it doesn't feel like I'm being rushed into doing something.
Takes the pressure off.
Right. Yeah. And then, but then I started, even like a couple of nights ago, I started feeling anxious about that, because I was like, oh, like I should be like, so I should be like turned on and like trying to have sex with them right now. And blah, blah, blah. But I didn't want to. And it wasn't because of him. It's just because, like, my nervous system is, like,
yeah,
calmer. I don't know. But then I, like, got worked up into my own head where I was like, oh, well, actually, no, like, start being sexual, start doing something. Right. And I couldn't just, like, let myself enjoy being there and resting.
One of the things my girlfriend and I will do sometimes is we will specifically, you know, get together and say, let's not have this lead to sex. Let's just, you know, be affectionate with each other. And I find, because I don't think she ever feels, well, I've never asked her, but I don't think she feels pressure sexually. I think because maybe women don't have to maintain an erection.
Right.
But for me, sometimes I put pressure on myself. It's never come from her.
Right.
And saying, you know, we're going to just cuddle on the couch, watch a movie, or just be affectionate with each other, I feel this great relief that I can just focus on the pleasure and the love.
Right.
And that was a revelation for me. I didn't realize how much pressure was there until I took the pressure off.
Right. So you didn't have, you're not feeling like rushed to be having sex with somebody or.
Right.
Yeah. It's a big thing for me. And I didn't realize that that's what it was. I've always like prided myself on being like this like sexual person. And now I'm like really seeing what that is. And I'm like, oh, that's like, it's okay to like be a sexual person. But like the fact that I was using it and didn't realize it as these like.
Right. Like, what is your intent when you're being sexual? That to me is really anything, any action in our daily lives. What is our intent?
Right. Exactly. You
know, that to me has been the biggest portal towards moving towards self-knowledge has been questioning myself. Why am I doing this?
And that's the greatest thing about sobriety is that it really opens you up to like looking at this stuff and like and you can like really start to ask yourself these questions. And you just become so much more self-aware on like a different level.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's been a really eye-opening experience, like being sober and then like getting to know myself in that way and then like sexually as well. But like, I definitely like, I think like the sexual issues started when I was pretty young. And like, that's some stuff that I'm like starting to uncover in therapy, which is...
Were there... incidents of abuse that sexualized you?
I think so. I think the more that I like think about little instances in my life, I'm like, oh, maybe that was actually like molestation. And, you know, maybe that was an incident where I wasn't in control of my body and somebody else was. And then like, you know, when I got to be, I lost my virginity really young, 13, 12 and a half, 13. And ever since then, it was like the string of men that came after. It was that same feeling of like, oh, I'm having sex with them to keep them like stay here, stay here, stay here.
Right.
So I've never really experienced so much like the I guess like sexually compulsive in ways with my partners. But I've never been the kind of person that like just goes and like sleeps with a bunch of people.
Right.
But it's like I'm having sex with people to keep them. And it's always been people who like didn't want to really be with me.
And what were the thoughts going through your head when you would be sexual with them? Were you looking for some type of reaction or some sentence to come out of their mouth that you would find? What was the payoff for you other than sexual pleasure?
Like, what was I seeking?
Yes.
Definitely, like, you know, just love. Like, you just want somebody to be like, you're... Like, every, you know, I just wanted somebody to be like, I love you, I want to be with you. And I never, like, really got that. And I didn't know why. So then it became kind of this, like, my mindset became like, okay, well, then I'm just going to be a bad bitch and, like, just, like, fuck people. And then I can, like, take my power back. And it, like, never worked out that way.
Because you didn't enjoy it.
No, I really didn't. And, like, it's funny, I was talking to my boyfriend about this. I was like, do you have any people that you like regret sleeping with? And he's like, no. And I was like, that's so funny, because if you like, almost everybody I've slept with, I regret, you know?
Really?
Almost everybody. I go through my list of people and I'm like, yeah, could have done without that one. Could have done without that one. Could have, you know, so I have like five that I'm like, yeah, that's good. Five out of like 37 where I'm like, yeah, that's, could have done without so many of those.
So let's go back to when you were a kid or in adolescence. What do you remember being some views on yourself or the world or sexuality or relationships that kind of got implanted in your head that you feel like maybe are still there that you're trying to unwind? My dog is
crazy. The dog is going off.
Yeah. Come here, Gracie.
She's so cute.
She's the best.
She's so cute.
Come here.
She is so
excited.
Go chew
a sock, huh? Go chew a sock.
I'm getting so distracted. Yeah. Oh, I'm such bad ADHD. Okay, wait. Rewind.
So what were some beliefs that you had that you're now unwinding when you were a kid? You know, it could be that, I'm only, my body is only good to keep people, or you can't trust men, or whatever, or I'm a piece of shit.
Right. I definitely, the belief system that I've been navigating on and I'm trying to undo now is the low self-esteem. First of all, is like, I'm a piece of shit. I'm not worthy.
Keep going. Give me the greatest hits.
Yeah. Right. The greatest hits. I'm a piece of shit. I'm not worthy. But at the same time, still being like, but I'm also cool. Like, which is very confusing when you have low self-esteem, but you're also like, I'm the shit. But then I'm like, but no, you're not. Fuck you. You know?
I'm sure you've heard the phrase that I don't know who coined it, but I'm a piece of shit the world revolves around.
Yeah.
So relate to that.
It's so, and you know, it's so funny, like, it, like being in programs, you hear so much of that too. And I hear so many people be like, yeah, I'm the coolest. No, I'm not. I'm a piece of shit. And I'm like, ah, I fucking relate to that so much. But that's,
and the fact that we're neither.
It's
I think the ego can only comprehend being better than or less than. I think it's terrifying to the ego to be one of many because it's out of a job.
Yeah, right. And I have realized recently too that I think I have a bigger ego than I realized. You know, just like that's kind of what rules my life, is like having a big ego, and I have like yet to decide if that's a good or a bad thing. I don't know. But some of the other hits that I'm unwinding now, let's see. Using my body as kind of like, I don't want to say dump truck, but that is what comes to mind. It's just being like, oh, you know, like it doesn't, like this doesn't matter. Like I don't matter. Nah. You matter. Like you can do what you want. Like, and I'll just.
You need to drop that off? Yeah, come on over here.
Right. And that's a big, you know, like fuck my feelings. It's all about you. Let me just take care of you. But also at the same time, realizing that like that's also selfish. I'm like, you know, that kind of thought process where it's like very selfless. It's also selfish.
I'm glad you said that, because that's something that so many of us don't realize or realize really late in life.
Yeah.
Is that we're objectifying somebody when we turn them into a fantasy.
Right.
And just say, you know, I'm going to, we're being codependent. We are also being selfish because we put all the pressure on them.
Yeah.
And we don't take a healthy look at ourselves. We're
absolutely.
Like, what can I mean to you?
Right. And then you get upset at them and you're like, you've hurt my feelings. I've had a lot of hurt feelings, so many hurt fucking feelings with men. And now I'm realizing it and I'm like, oh, that wasn't, but it, like, it wasn't their job either to like take care of my feelings. Like I needed to be regulating myself and like knowing when to pull away from unhealthy relationships and
to express yourself in a way that's diplomatic at the right time with the right words, with the right tone.
Right. And that's also all childhood stuff. You know, I never saw like a healthy example of that in my home growing up. It was very just like chaotic and fuck you. And nobody ever expressed emotions in a healthy way. And I'm not like, you know, I'm not like resentful at my parents for that. They were just, you know, the whole thing of like, they just did the best they could with what they knew. Yeah. But now I'm like, okay, what's a way that I can move forward in my life in a healthy way without repeating those fucking patterns?
Yeah.
Break the cycle.
Was there a bottom for you, in drinking or drugging or relationships that you just had a kind of a moment of clarity that something needed to change?
Yeah, I mean, it was a series of things. I think I think a series of things led me up to like the final moment of being like, oh, this isn't good. I got sober January 4th of last year, right after like a really kind of nasty breakup. And it was like pretty devastating, but it wasn't devastating 100% like because of him. It was devastating because he was like a reflection of all of the things that I wasn't taking care of in myself, if that makes sense.
Oh, it makes total sense.
Right. So I was using this guy to kind of like numb all of these issues that I needed to be taken care of. And then when he like ultimately kept rejecting me, it was like, I was like spinning out of control and I was drinking a lot. And like after that breakup, like a month after, I was like, you're not ever going to recover from this breakup. You're not going to recover from your habits if you don't fucking stop. And I had gotten I got a DUI last year. And even after that, it was like, up until I had the breathalyzer installed in my car, which was like 2 months after getting my DUI, I would still like drink and drive, you know, like I got the DUI and I was like, I'm fine. And I like would still drink. And then eventually when the thing got installed, I was like, okay, so we can't drink and drive anymore.
What are we going to do?
Right. And I still didn't see it as a problem because like, I was just like, a lot of people get DUIs. Like, it's just a thing. And it was like kind of funny to me. And then the more I realized like it wasn't that funny and it just wasn't funny and it stopped being cute. You know, I was like, it's not really that cute to be like this, like drunk all over the place girl. And then I went through that breakup and I was like, okay, I have a DUI. I don't have a boyfriend. And I was dating somebody who didn't ever want to be with me. And like the relationship before that was the same thing. And, you know, and then like after that, I was like, we have to stop, like stop and reevaluate. And that was just kind of the big, I'm like, in retrospect, I'm very happy about that relationship ending, because I'm like, if I didn't, I wouldn't have gotten sober. No. I would have kept repeating the same problems. I would have like kept going out like almost every night and doing coke and getting fucked up and, you know, blah 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 blah. And after it ended, I was like, okay, well, time to reevaluate and be alone.
Isn't it amazing when we look back and a disaster was a gift? It's right. So mind-blowing.
It is. And it's never, it's like never, you realize how much of the issue is you and not the other people. And that's been a big lesson for me, is like, oh, I'm like the root of my problems in a lot of ways.
You're the common denominator.
Yeah, right. And I started reading that book, The Four Agreements, which has some really fucking good nuggets of information. Have you read it?
No.
Oh, you haven't?
No.
It's a really good, like, little simple kind of self-help book. But one of, like, the agreements in the Four Agreements is, like, don't take anything personally, which is a big one where it's, like, nothing is about you.
So little of life is about us.
Right. Yeah. Right. So it's just been a bunch of interesting, eye-opening revelations and undoings.
So as you started to unnumb yourself from the obsessive, you know, trying to keep this guy or get to a place in your relationship with him that felt like a finish line or the place you wanted to be, and you stopped drinking, I imagine a lot of feelings came up when you were just sitting in that stillness. What were the feelings, and what were you doing to try to numb yourself or distract yourself?
You know, I feel like I'm still, you know, like I still am in pretty early sobriety, so things are still like, I'm still getting used to things being quiet. And I feel like in the last like month or two, I've really been able to be like, okay, like I feel a little bit more leveled out. But like, it was, you know, it was really difficult because I am really obsessive in nature. I have been since I was little. Like, there's one thing that I can remember about myself from a really young age. It was just like being obsessive. And not to go too far off of that question, but my therapist was like, you know, a sign of a kid having like a hypersexual kid and a really obsessive kid is early childhood like sexual trauma. And I was like, I don't know what that And I don't know if I've, like, buried it really deep down. I don't really know where it comes from. There's a few instances, like I said, that I can kind of relate to that being, like, early sexual childhood trauma. But the obsessiveness... Anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it all fucking...
Did you... Go ahead and finish your thought.
But the obsessiveness after, like, that, like, breakup kind of... It took a while to wear off because then... Even after I stopped drinking and doing drugs, it was like, then I had social media and I was like, well, I'll just look at his social media every 5 seconds and I'll create an account and like, look at it and da da da. And I'll, you know, try and find ways to like get him to notice me again. And it's, and then like my sober brain was like, stop. Like, this is why, like, you got sober so like you could cut this pain in half. And like, that has been a fucking, and I'm like finally over that hump now. But it took a long time.
Yeah. What do we call that? Switching the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Right. That's exactly. And then, you know, then you numb out with other things like social media. And now I'm like so addicted to being on my phone. It's so bad.
What's the dream, you know, when you get on your phone that you think is going to, that somebody has retweeted something 100,000 times?
Exactly. I'm like, what do I think? That somebody, like, I'm finally going to like get famous and some, you know, agent is going to be like, you're the one we've been looking for. Like, that's in my fucking fantasy head, you know?
Yeah.
And like, to an extent, that does happen with social media. Like, it is instant gratification, but I'd never walk away from it feeling like, fuck yeah, I feel so good. You know, it's such a short hit.
Yeah. You never hear anybody go, Instagram made me whole.
Yeah, right. That's why everybody's like, I need to get offline, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody's like, I need to be more on Instagram. We're all trying to get off of it, and we can't.
You talked about being hypersexual as a kid.
Yeah.
Did you feel shame about that? Did other people shame you? What were your thoughts, or did you just feel like you were just another kid?
So, God, that is, there's so much to unpack in that question. I definitely started noticing, I mean, I like lived so much in my own world, but like, I like started masturbating really young, but like not knowing it was masturbating in that way, you know, just like leaning on things or like having just things that I was like, oh, this feels good. And maybe that's like a normal kid thing to do. I'm pretty sure it is.
I think kids exploring their bodies is, I think when it's compulsive, there might be something underneath that, but I'm a jackass that tells dick jokes. So, you know,
right.
Just from what I've read and the people I've interviewed, you know, there's a continuum.
Right. It's, yeah, God, also I feel like every comedian has like the same trauma in so many ways, but I remember from a really young age, like, I was like always drawing like figures with like big fat tits and like naked, you know, but I was like young and like drawing things, having sex, and like 9 is a young age to be drawing.
That's really, yeah. And, right. And for it to be so specific and graphic, were you exposed to pornography?
I don't fucking know. I must have been somewhere along the line. You know, like, I had older brothers, and maybe, like, I, like, heard or saw them having sex or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I couldn't, like, pinpoint exactly where it comes from, but I just remember being very young and, like, having, like, I remember, like, disassociating with, like, sexual thoughts when I was really young. Like, a lot of the time, like, long drives when I would be with my family, I would just, like, be sitting in the backseat just, like, thinking about, like, sex scenes. And that's... I was
making up sex scenes?
Yeah. And I was fucking young, like, between, like, 8 and 11.
What were the nature of them? How realistic were they? Or were they, you know...
Pretty graphic. How a kid...
Wow.
Yeah.
That.
I know.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because I was a hypersexual kid who thought about sex constantly, but I also had a completely clueless, like, I thought once a man and a woman had sex, that the babies just came out like a slot machine. All you had to do was have sex once.
So funny.
And then you would, and the person that dissuaded me from that idea was a friend of mine who had 13 brothers and sisters. And I was like, I could never look his mom in the eye for like a couple of years.
Yeah.
I was like, your mom is fucked over 13 times.
Funny.
That like blew my mind.
That's so funny too. I remember like finding out that my mom had sex more than one time.
Yeah.
Because it was the same idea of like, you only have sex to like have a kid or whatever.
Right.
And I was like, ew, no, right. No, she hasn't.
Were you picturing yourself as being a part of these, or were you picturing that this was something that you were watching?
I think that it was always me imagining two like non-existent people. They were just kind of like figures that I had made up in my head.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And I just remember dissociating a lot as a kid with like sexual fantasy. And then like also just other things. Like I was just like in fantasy land so much of my life.
For me, it was about the visual. Mm-hmm. Like it was never even on my radar, mm-hmm. like wanting to touch a vagina,
yeah.
or wanting to be touched. It was just all, boy, if I could just see, you know,
really?
That lifeguard without her bottoms on,
yeah.
oh, my life would be complete.
Huh.
You know?
And
it was kind of an obsessive thing. But then again, people rarely tell you how often they're thinking sexual thoughts. So you never know if
yeah.
you're in the normal range or the
exactly.
abnormal range.
But. And then if you talk about it, you're like not supposed to talk about it. So then you feel ashamed for talking about it when you're little. So it is very fucking confusing. And I'm a big advocate of like normalizing talking about sex. And, you know, like I think it's just because everybody fucking does it, and everybody has like weird dark things surrounding it, and like that's my favorite. It's like my favorite subject because it's this one thing that we all have in common, and there's a lot of like interesting aspects to it. It's not just like sex. Like there's so much psychology rooted with sex.
It's what is it, the saying? Sex is about everything except sex.
Right. Yeah. And it really is.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me.
It's about control mm-hmm. and power and
right.
validation
right.
and love. And it's such a mixed, it can be about anger. It can be
so
about.
So much, right.
Yeah.
Right. It's so loaded.
Are you comfortable talking about sexual fantasies, stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't, do you have any questions about it?
When I interview people who struggle with intimacy mm-hmm. issues, and especially people who are open talking about their
yeah.
sexuality, you know, for instance, we had a guest on about a year ago, and she shared that the only way that she can come is if she imagines someone choking her.
Interesting.
To death. I have a friend who can only come when he imagines his girlfriend cheating on him.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm just endlessly fascinated
yeah.
by what it is. And as much as that,
yeah.
how comfortable that person is with talking about it.
Yeah.
With not judging themselves
yeah.
for it, you know?
Yeah.
I had this fantasy, and it's interesting because fantasies for me will come and go as I kind of recover and
uh-huh.
and I change or evolve as a person. But I don't know, this is probably 10-15 years ago, I was delivering food to old people, and there was this one lady, she was a grandma, that I would deliver food to, and I would get so aroused anticipating delivering the food to her.
Wow.
Imagining her wanting, imagining me having some reason that I had to take my clothes off.
No way.
And being naked in front of her and her, I mean, it was super specific. Like then she would, wow. You know, do something to like, you know, care for my body or, you know, do something. It was total mommy shit. Total mommy shit. But
Freudian.
It freaked me out.
Yeah.
It filled me with shame.
Yeah.
And it was a while before I could kind of unpack it and look back and go, oh, that was, you know, that was totally related to childhood shit and mom issues. And I can laugh about it now and I can talk about it. But at the time, if somebody had known that about me, I would have seriously considered suicide.
Really?
Yeah.
That
and
is
so I guess that's what one of the things I'm interested in is not only the things that we judge ourselves for sexually thinking or feeling, but what's the judgment about and has that evolved over time?
And the fact it's so interesting that you can like openly talk about that like that now, whereas you know, years ago, you literally would have like contemplated suicide had somebody figured it out, and how much more freeing it is to just like talk about it and be like, oh, it's just like a fantasy.
It's just a thing. And it's not, our fantasies have so little to do with who we are morally.
Totally.
And
totally.
It's not a choice.
Right.
What turns us on is not a choice. What we do with it is a choice.
Right. That's so fucking crazy.
Yeah.
That's so fucking crazy. I mean, that's why I love doing that thing that like tea time shit that I do of like asking people, you know, like, what are your fetishes and hearing about like the other things like that people go through or, you know, I think it's like it's therapeutic for people who are watching because they're like, okay, I'm not the only one who has these fantasies. And I don't really have any fetishes. I do think about women a lot, like, and that is like usually what helps me get off is if I think about women. But then I also don't think, I mean, I don't know. I've never really had like a sexual relationship with a woman. So I'm like, I don't know if I'm, you know, bisexual or gay or what's going on there. But it is definitely like that's whenever I watch porn, it's like very about women or I think about women. Mm-hmm. But that's really...
I've read 7,000 plus surveys that people have filled out about, you know, trauma, sexual fantasy, all of that stuff. And what you just said is the most common one
that
I read of women, straight women.
Really?
Yeah. And to me, ultimately, it doesn't matter whether they're straight or gay or whatever.
Right.
It's just, you know, what you do with it. Are you judging yourself for it?
Yeah.
Do you judge yourself for it?
No, I don't. I really don't because it doesn't. No.
Have you shared that with a partner?
Yeah, and I talk about that a lot, like with my friends and stuff, or like what kind of porn we watch, or blah blah blah. Yeah, but I have that is something like that I'm not afraid to talk about.
When I began finding out about the inner lives of women from doing the podcast and getting to know female fellows and my support groups, I was shocked at how many women get off on watching porn that is degrading to women.
Yeah, I can't. That's interesting, though. I do have a lot of friends who are really into, like, I have some friends who are, like, really into, like, gnarly gangbanging videos, and I'm like, oh, no, I can't. Yeah. No.
Yeah, that seems like that's one of those things that there's no in-between on it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I, like, no judgment to anybody that does. It's just for me, I'm like, I can't. The really hardcore stuff is not for me.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of that.
Yeah. I'm very, very vanilla when it comes to like sexual fantasies, you know. I don't have any like outrageous. I remember one time years ago, I was like over my friend's house and she had her laptop out. I don't think she was home, but I like opened up her laptop to like look something up and it was and she's gay and it was like the gnarliest kink like lesbian shit I had ever seen. And I opened it, I was like, what the fuck is going on here? And I don't remember if I ever brought it up to her, but it was like, it was what, you know, it was like in like clamps and hanging from something and like hitting each other. I was like, what the fuck?
Isn't it great though that she has an outlet to express that, and hopefully she doesn't feel shame about it if it's consenting adults.
And there shouldn't be. I mean, there's so much shit that shouldn't be. There shouldn't be a lot of shame around consensual, you know, fetishes. You know, of course, like when you dip into like not consensual and child shit, that's where it's a big issue. But the rest of it, it's like if they're all consenting adults, then it's fine.
You want to jerk off while somebody pops balloons?
Right.
That's awesome.
Right, right.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was one of my Tea Time episodes was like, what are your like wildest fetishes? A lot of shit fetishes.
That's the thing when I was kind of doing research on you, and I went to your Instagram, I clicked the things at the top that the little Instagram posts that you had, and the one about the fetishes and the other ones about the family secrets. It was just so compelling. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to, because I figured if you were willing to talk about that on your thing, that you would be probably comfortable talking about it on the podcast.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's what I'm starting.
I'm feeling a little bit of shame about asking that.
Oh, really?
One of my fears is that I'm going to come across as creepy.
Oh, no.
Or not having boundaries, asking people questions. It's kind of a fine line because I want to get an interview that's compelling and goes deep, but I also want to be respectful.
Right.
Especially when it's a woman.
Right. That makes total sense. And I do open myself up in that way. So it doesn't like catch me. It doesn't like catch me off guard or like offend me, because that is the way that like I open myself up. So I expect it. And I'm starting a podcast. That is exactly what I do on my Instagram, but now I'm just going to bring it over a podcast because it's easier to, you know, just be more interesting that way. But I wanted to do the exact format, and I was thinking about it on the way over, like, what do I want the, like, next, because I'm going to have people email me, you know, about, like, the subject matter, like, family secrets or fetishes or da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And it's so fascinating.
It's so fascinating.
I know. I love it.
Yeah.
I fucking love it. And I'll judge myself for thinking about it as often as I do.
The podcast or sex?
Sex, like sex stuff, but like not even at this point, like not even like in a sexual way. Like I'm always thinking about like people's like sexual lives, and then I feel like, should I be thinking about this? But to me, it's like it's so much less about the sex than it is about like the way that people express themselves. I don't know, but I do think about it a lot.
I think that's pretty normal. Like if I'm in a coffee shop and, you know, somebody walks up, you know, male, female, whatever, picture him naked, picture him taking his shit, you know,
wild.
Picture him crying, you know, whatever, just picturing them as a full-fledged human being.
Yeah.
And it's not like I sit there and I obsess. It's just like a flash.
Yeah.
And I used to judge myself for that, and now I'm just kind of amused by the animation festival in my head.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times it's related to anxiety, too.
Do you think?
I do.
Do you have bad anxiety?
I do. I do,
God,
definitely.
I have such bad anxiety.
Talk about that.
Oh, so I think about it constantly. I was walking today and I was like, why am I always so fucking anxious? Like, even in my moments of like relaxation, I'm just always like sped up and anxious, and I never have like a really restful moment.
Yeah.
You know?
I wonder if body work would be a beneficial thing for you, like EMDR or somatic experiencing. That can release a lot of shit, a lot of trauma, especially trauma that can't be spoken, especially if stuff's buried, because the body holds that stuff in. The mind may not be able to make sense of it, but that might be a really big step for you.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. It's like, I have this other part of me that I also need to, I have so much shit that I need to work through, but like, I have the really cynical part of me is always like, oh, don't fucking, like, you're not going to heal. Like, don't do that. Like, you don't need to do body work. Like, that's so
new age.
Right.
Hippie.
Yeah. Right. And I'm like, no, just fucking get through it on your own. Like, da, da, da. But it's, you know, a big part of me like doesn't want to believe it and then doesn't want to do the work.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's like a defense mechanism. It's this like wall that I have up that I don't want to like let down.
Don't open the door.
Right.
We're okay in here.
Right.
But stop like, knocking.
Right. But we're like so not.
We're so not. Describe what it feels like in your brain and your body when you're in that anxious state.
Oh, fuck. It's just, I mean, I'd like have a very hard time ever feeling like actual calmness and actual joy. I don't feel happy a lot of the time. Like I'm like happy, but I don't feel it in my core of like gratitude, and like I never feel like I've done well enough, you know. It's like it's always chasing that, okay, well I need more, like I'm still not where I want to be, my career's not where I want it to be, I don't have enough money, like I'm never just like, yeah, things are good. And it's that constant,
it's exhausting.
I am so exhausted being in my head, which is why I was fucking got so also so into drinking, because it was so easy to be like, okay.
Get that deep breath that you were looking for.
Right.
It's just all the side effects of that, you know, weaving in and out of traffic and all the other shit that makes it unmanageable. But, if I could manage drinking, I would still be drinking. But it's just the rest of the shit that came with it, you know.
I know. I still have such a hard time accepting that I'm an alcoholic too. I'm like, well, maybe I'm not, but then it's like, but why even chance it again?
Right.
You know, like it wasn't doing me that well before.
Right.
So why try and do it now?
COVID has made me think about it more. Never to the point where I'm like, yeah, maybe I should drink, but to where I would, you know, picture a drink, and rather than it just being like, oh my God, you know, play that tape through, that's a fucking disaster, I'd be like, well, maybe not. Maybe I'll, what are you doing?
Yeah, yeah. COVID has been a wild experience for sobriety. I was like, I totally think that if I wasn't sober during this, I would have become such a drug addict. I would have become such an alcoholic. Like, I would have leaned so far into it.
I completely agree.
Right.
I mean, isolating and getting fucked up, oh, that was a sweet combo for me.
Oh, the best.
You know.
The best. Yeah, and I would have done it.
You don't have to share.
Yeah. God, so great. I did love going out and getting fucked up, because when I could go out and get fucked up, that's when I didn't have like anxiety about being out anymore, you know?
Yeah.
It's so much easier to like be out with people and be fucked up.
Yeah.
And when you get sober, the interesting thing about being sober now and being around people is that it's like started to turn me off so much more, because it's so fucking boring. Being around fucked up people when you're sober, you're like...
It is so boring. I don't find it making me want to drink, quite the opposite. It makes me... It makes me want to leave. But if I'm around a group of people and we're talking about something that's deep, that I find that energizing. I was at a party one time and we all just started getting honest about darkness in our brains. And
I love that.
And I was like, this is the first party I never wanted to end.
Was it a sober party?
No. Some people were drinking, but the group I was talking to, they weren't big drinkers.
Okay.
They were more, I think we all started talking about our struggles with depression and stuff like that. And then we started talking about shit that happened to us in childhood.
Yeah.
And it was like this connection that I'd never felt at a party before.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't really hate parties. I hate kind of this normal conversation. I hate small talk.
That's another thing that is all that like does kind of like haunt me, is my inability to like make good small talk whenever I'm around people. Like I always, it's that thing of like wanting to go right into like the super vulnerable stuff,
right,
where I'm like, I want to fucking talk about like the like nastiest, saddest, weirdest, most vulnerable moments.
Which bridge do you picture throwing yourself off of?
Oh, right. I love those.
Where's everybody going?
Yeah. I love those. Yeah. Talk to me about death and suicide and all of the crazy shit you want to do. I love it.
Yeah.
It's always, you know, it's always so boring to me when you bring up something dark and somebody's like, oh, that's dark. And you're like, oh, fuck off.
Yeah.
Oh, get the fuck over it. And I'm with those people. I'm like, do you not really think about this stuff? Or do you just not allow yourself to?
Yeah. Or do you not want it to be known that you think about those things?
It blows my mind when people are like, TMI, man. I'm like, what do you mean TMI? I love TMI.
Yeah.
I love it. The nastier, the weirder people get, like, the more comfortable I feel. Because I'm like, oh, you can be honest.
Yeah.
You know how to be honest.
I agree. Yeah.
Right.
The only place I might draw the line is talking about certain things when I'm eating.
Oh, yeah.
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 I don't want to hear about somebody taking a shit when I'm, when I'm eating.
That doesn't bother me.
Yeah?
Yeah, no. I don't get grossed out with that stuff.
Yeah.
That's funny. It feels pretty normal.
You got quite a few tattoos. Could I sound like an older fart? Young lady,
yeah.
What's with all the drawings on the arms and legs?
You got a lot, yeah. I do.
What do you enjoy about getting tattoos?
So, you know, I've gotten...
Do you enjoy the process of it?
I do.
Picking it, getting it done?
Yeah, I love it. It's also, you know, so many answers to this. I've gotten probably 89% of them during quarantine. So the past 6 months, I've just been like going in a tattoo shop and being like, I have money and time. Let's do it.
Right.
And nothing else to do. And I talked to my therapist about it, and I was like, I keep getting all these tattoos. And she was like, you know, that's another thing that addicts do. And I was like, oh, is it? And she's like, yeah, you're looking for another rush, another hit of something. And I'm like, that does make
video
so much
games,
sense.
Food, compulsive exercising.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are the big ones. Sugar, when we get sober, those are the top
so
choices.
Sugar. It's so much fucking sugar. Yeah. The tattoos have been a big thing.
And when you find a tattoo, is it something that you are excited to get because you like what it says or stands for, or that it you feel like it's a reflection of who you are inside?
Not at all.
You just want something that looks cool?
Yes, it. I that's really it. I have no rhyme or reason to any of the ones that I have. I have one of Frida Kahlo on my back, which is probably the only one that I've put real thought into.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, the rest of them, it's like I walk into a tattoo shop and I'm like, that one? You know, like, I pick something off the wall. I'm like, that looks good. Or like... One of them, I have a woman on my arm, and that was all because the tattoo artist was like, I really want to do... this type of woman. And I was like, well, yeah, go ahead. Yeah. I don't care. And that's just it. There's no, I like kind of enjoy it more that way though.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that kind of how we should walk through life?
Mm-hmm.
Like
maybe
it's a smorgasbord. Let's try it.
Right.
You know, at the end of our lives,
right.
Are we going to smile about the safety that we employed,
right.
Or about the times we just kind of threw caution to the wind, assuming it's not hurting somebody.
Right, right, right.
And just tried a new experience.
That's really what it is. I mean, because then I also think that if I was to put too much thought into one of them, eventually I'd be like, oh, this is so fucking stupid. Rather than when I
was just, so pretentious.
Yeah, rather than when I can just walk into somewhere and be like, I'll take that one. It has no meaning. And I'm like, oh, that's fine. Like, it's not going to do it. I'm not going to outgrow it. I mean, maybe I will, but it's not like a... you know, anything with like powerful meaning.
Yeah.
So it's fun. I like the way it feels. It's kind of meditative and it makes me like focus on actual physical pain rather than like the mental pain.
Yeah. Do you get an endorphin rush during it or after it?
Big time.
Yeah.
Big time. And I'm a huge adrenaline seeker, which I'm finding out, I guess, is like another quality of an addict.
Yep.
And I always talk to this with my therapist about this with my therapist, where I'm like, do you really think I'm an addict? And she's like, yeah, like an addict is an addict is an addict through and through. And she's like, you know, I think your biggest issues lie with your relationships with men, but like it trickles down into the way that you spend money. It trickles down into the way that you drink and do drugs. It trickles down into, you know, numbing and da-da-da. Like, it's all part of the same beast.
Yeah.
Ugh, exhausting. So So I'll just keep getting tattoos. That's what I'm just...
Is there anything you want to share before we wrap up?
How are we wrapping? Oh, wow. That went by so fast.
Yeah, that was an hour.
Was it really an hour?
Yeah.
Wow, that was fast.
I'm in no hurry. If you got more stuff you want to talk about,
if you have any question, anything you want to keep shooting out, I have no.
Let's do it. Let's end with this. There's a thing I do with guests sometimes called a fear off and a love off, where we exchange fears and then we exchange things we love. So I'll start off with the fear. I'm afraid Gracie has fucked this episode up, and it's going to be difficult to edit out her huffing and puffing.
I don't think it was that bad. Yeah. I have a fear of, what's my fear? See, then I think about this stuff and my brain immediately shuts down. That's like my lack of, that's where the wall comes up, where I'm like, anything that comes up, anything that's like serious, I have like a fear of seriousness in a lot of ways. Of, I'm afraid of like, if I say something that it's going to sound really dumb or corny.
And that's that a good one.
Is a big,
Yeah, I like that one.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that I will let my guard down. Well, I already have let it down with COVID because I've been playing hockey a couple of times a week. And I'm afraid that I'm going to get the virus. I'm going to be one of the people that hits super, super hard. And I'm going to slowly die. And as I'm dying, I will see every mistake I made, and my last feelings on earth will be just feeling stupid.
That is horrific.
Yeah, that's my brain most of the day.
That feels very...
It's exhausting.
I feel that, though.
Yeah.
That is, like, being like this fear, like being exposed. I'm like, what am I... Who's going to expose me? What am I... Yeah.
Give me a fear.
That's a good fear. I have a fear of not making it in my field. I have a fear of like never getting. I mean, I hate to say this, but I do have like a fear of like never getting famous. Mm-hmm. And I hate that that's like a fear. I'm like, who gives a fuck? But then another part of me is like, but I want it so badly.
Do you want the financial security that you hope comes with it, or is it the attention that you want?
Honestly, both. It's like the luxury and like the money, and then also the attention. I love attention. That's also a part of like my addictive personality, is like I need, that's why I'm also on social media all the time, because I'm like, I just need people like looking at me and interacting with me, and I just need it like all the time, just like validate me. So yeah, that's, if I was never, I don't know how people just live regular lives. I'm like, how do you not want attention all of the time? How do you not want to be so famous? It blows me away. Blows me away. I don't know how people don't want it.
I can understand how people don't want it. I used to want it really badly, and I wouldn't say it's completely left me, but when I was doing TV stuff, I began to experience somebody stopping me on the street, somebody saying this, somebody asking for an autograph. And it was never the fantasy that it was in my head.
You know,
a lot of times it was somebody that would, you know, have bad breath and make an offhand comment or be a little too pushy. And it never calmed my anxiety. It was never enough.
Right.
At a certain point, I realized that I actually like not being recognized.
Yeah.
Because like being in a room after, well, I'm sure you've experienced this, being in a room after a stand-up show and people are like, oh, that's a person that was on stage, and you're getting more, you feel like you're under a microscope, and that makes me anxious.
Yeah, it does actually make me anxious too, but in this weird way, I also get off on it.
Yeah.
Because like, when that does happen, I immediately like go inside of myself, and I don't know how to like interact with people, and I'm like, I get like really small, but then I also like want it so badly.
I get that. The thing that would scare me about getting really famous is then you lose the choice of anonymity.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, I liked that I got just a teeny tiny taste of it, so I could know a little bit what it's like, but I haven't risked, I don't even, like when I'm walking out in public, I don't even think about it. When I was first on TV, yeah. I would think about it all the time. Yeah. I would be like, is anybody going to recognize me? You know, and I was also in a really different place right. where I had, like, I felt really empty, had no self-esteem,
yeah.
and I was looking for anything to validate me. But yeah. Nowadays, I would much rather have the money. I would
yeah.
much rather have
yeah,
the money.
Yeah, yeah, the,
that.
Yeah.
I always think authors would be the best way to be famous because you could pull it out when you wanted to.
Yeah.
But you could hide it when you wanted
not
to.
Not famous enough for me. Yeah. I get that. Except unless you're David Sedaris.
Yeah.
No, not even then.
I wouldn't be able to pick him
would
out
you
of,
not?
No.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. Being an author would be great.
Or somebody who, for me, like a musician like Jeff Beck,
mm-hmm.
whom a lot of people wouldn't recognize, but the people who would recognize him are people that
yeah.
like his music. And the people that like his music are generally people that tend to be, I think, a little more intelligent, a little
yeah.
more artistic, a little more
yeah.
on the fringe of society.
Right. So you don't just have, so you have a little bit more of a distinguished fan base. Like, yeah. Not just a bunch of 13-year-olds
yeah.
screaming at you when you walk down the street.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Can you, I want both.
I love that you're honest about that because I think for a long time I didn't want to admit that
yeah.
I had any of that in me.
It's so embarrassing.
And it used to be huge
yeah.
inside me.
Yes.
Huge inside me.
Yeah. I've like recently started admitting it and it's every time I say it I'm like yeah. like I can't believe I'm about to say that, but I mean it's true and it is what it is.
And I think underneath it, maybe this seems obvious, but that we just want to feel safe and loved.
That's what it is at the end of the day. I'm like, well, why, if I really analyze it, why do I want to be famous? It's like, because I want to connect with people and I have such like a desire to be able to like, because I love being able to relate with people and I mm-hmm. want people to also feel like they can relate to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where like, if I had a massive platform, then I would know that like I could reach out to people who would also, maybe I could make them feel comfortable with who they are. And that's like what the core of it is.
Yeah.
Is but wanting to feel relatable. Yeah.
It would be so hard though to get it on the level that you want it, where it doesn't feel like it's not enough or it's not an onslaught where you
right.
feel drained by it.
Right. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I'm giving you some stuff to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. I've already got so much. Now I've got more. What was the other one? Fears and then...
Loves.
What's yours?
I love when Gracie, I'd share this one with you before we got on mic. I love when Gracie gets excited because we're going to go for a walk and she chooses the way to demonstrate her celebrating is by grabbing a slipper and tossing it up into the air. That's, she just loves footwear. That's her like
she's flipping it
big foam
right
number
now.
One finger.
Yeah, it's so cute.
Yeah.
She loves that sock. I'm watching her chew it.
Yeah.
Loves. I fucking love coming home to my cats. I have two cats.
What are their
names? I'm obsessed with them. Pablo and Griselda. Obsessed
oh
with
my
them.
God, you're such a drug lord.
That's
freak.
What I named them after.
Oh, yeah.
That's so
I
funny.
I know. Griselda Blanco.
Yeah. Nobody
Dude,
knows that.
Fist bump.
Yeah,
fist
nobody
bump.
Knows Griselda
my
Blanco.
My girlfriend is so tired of me watching narco things.
Really?
So tired
yeah.
of it. Well, she's from Ecuador, and I
oh
think a
God,
lot of people
yeah.
from Latin America are tired. It's like, I'm from Chicago. We could care less about the gangster prohibition era.
Yeah.
That's like such a cliche to
yeah.
us. And so I think that's how a lot of people in Latin America
that's
feel
so
about
funny.
It. But, oh, fascinated. Watched the Cocaine Cowboys,
yeah.
all of them.
Okay.
All of them.
I
have you
seen
those documentaries?
No,
oh,
no.
my God.
What is that
You
on?
Have to. It's about the explosion of the drug trade in Miami in the 80s.
Maybe I have.
That's where she made her name.
I feel like there hasn't been a lot done on Griselda.
There's a couple of
Are there?
Things. Yeah. When we get off mic,
okay.
I'll tell you about them. But there's also a documentary where a young guy falls in love with her and they have
she
this.
She was a gnarly bitch.
She was a violent, violent woman. I mean, horrible, horrible child.
Did she behead all of her kids or shot them all?
I don't remember that, but but I think what you're thinking of is she ordered a hit one time and they were like, we can't, you know, it's a family. And she said, kill them all.
Oh, God.
And they killed the whole family.
Wild
she
woman.
Was the one that really brought savagery to another level in the drug war killing. She was the one that introduced civilians into it, into let's not only kill them, let's kill the people they love.
Oh, God. Ooh, yes. Nasty woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what my cat's named after. She is. I love them. Love those girls.
Yeah.
I thought Pablo was a boy when I got her, and it was after, you know, Pablo Escobar.
My girlfriend's cat is named Pablo.
Oh, really?
Oh, he's the best.
Cute.
Fucking love
him.
It's
a great name. Great name for a cat.
He's great. He got out, escaped, and just got his ass kicked by another cat. Oh. Tore a hole in his ear.
No.
Yeah, and he still wants to get out.
He's a house cat.
He's a house cat, yeah. But he thinks he's an outdoor cat.
My cats try to escape all the time. Sometimes they do. And it's scary.
There's a lot of coyotes, man. You got to be careful.
Oh, yeah.
You got to be careful.
Yeah, I would I would lose my mind if they ever got out and never came. I would lose my mind.
Here's a really recent one. It's a little corny, but I love the song Country Roads by John Denver. The chord changes in it and the melody. There's something about when the chords go from major chords to minor chords and somebody picks the right note, it opens up something in my heart that's kind of feels beautiful but also really sad at the same time.
Yeah.
And that song does it. And I listened to it today 25 times in a row.
Yeah.
25 times in a row.
I get that. I definitely get that. You know, I'll get hooked on a song that'll just like make me feel so good. That is, I do love finding new songs like that, that just you listen to it over and over and over again. And you're like, oh, this is so good. I've never done heroin, but I would imagine that's what it feels like.
I've never done heroin, but I imagine it feels as good as dropping family off at the airport.
I'm sure it does. God, that's got to feel better.
Give me another love.
Another love. You know, I love, besides getting tattoos, I mean, it's all, I feel like it's very surface level.
It's all right.
Yeah, I love going to sleep next to my boyfriend. I really do love that.
What's his name?
His name's Shane.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that. I really look forward to that where I'm like, oh, it's just like going to be a nice night where we can just like, I do love that. I really look forward to that. And I also love right after I get my eyelashes done. That's another thing I fucking love.
I love the feeling after a haircut.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially the first time you wash your hair after a haircut.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
That does feel really good. Clean sheets. Love that.
Gabby, thank you for coming in and being so open and honest, and keep kicking ass in all your programs and all your recovery.
Yeah.
That's really awesome to hear.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This has been awesome.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah. 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 Hell yeah.
Many, many thanks to Gabby. This episode is sponsored by When Breath Becomes Air. When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we are alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor turned patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present? When the future is no longer a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean to have a child, to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Let's dive into some surveys. This is from the racism survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Too Far From Home. She is Asian, and she writes, I was 11 years old when I first moved to Canada from China. I was getting registered at a local school, and the admin asked me what my name was. They couldn't pronounce it at all, so without prompting, they said, we'll call you Susan. My parents and I didn't know what to say, so the last thing I remember from that meeting was them saying, bye, Susan. You remember how you felt when it happened? I didn't feel much, but maybe I was overwhelmed by all the newness. I remember thinking that I already chose an English name for myself, but at the time I was hesitant to declare that English name officially. But I remember I thought the name Susan was so not for me. No offense to Susans, but it sounded like a boring old white woman's name. How do you feel about it now? I'm overall grateful for how truly diverse that school was. It was a really good mix of all the races. Many were immigrants. As soon as school started, I put down the English name that I chose for myself, which I still go by, and my documents still say my Chinese name. It's really like having two identities sometimes, which is at times inconvenient, at times gives me a feeling of disconnect, like no one can truly know my whole self, and at times something to be proud of. But it forever ruined the name Susan for me. Any thoughts or feelings you'd like to share? I'm a Chinese immigrant. I'm not a victim of racism or oppression because I never internalized white supremacy thanks to a thorough understanding of my own cultural backgrounds and of world geopolitical history. As an immigrant, I'm not here to take advantage of an American system of liberal freedom or whatever. I don't agree or respect the founding of the colonial nations on this land, but I'm a settler just like the European settlers. The difference is that my ancestors didn't form unfair treaties with the indigenous peoples here or stole their land or committed genocide. These are the affirmations I tell myself when I feel conflicted about living on this land instead of living in my homeland of China. Thank you for sharing that. There's so many experiences that are such new experiences to me when I read the surveys, and I'm so grateful for them. It is, doing this podcast, I feel like I have, learned so many things that I probably would have never in my lifetime gotten to hear or, read. This is from the love survey filled out by Heidi Ho, and she writes, this is such a simple one. I love it when I'm driving and the sunlight changes at a transitional moment in a song. That is, I love it any moment where you feel like the universe is giving you a little nod. This is from the racism survey filled out by a black man who calls himself Ionic Sax Condom. No idea what that means. And he writes, this event was something I witnessed while traveling on the Megabus back when Megabus first became a thing in the U.S. Megabus is similar to Greyhound, but only goes to major cities and is usually cheaper than Greyhound. Their gimmick was travel for as low as a dollar. I've never paid a dollar for a ticket, but I once had a round trip from Cleveland to Cincinnati for only $8. That's besides the point, though. It was somewhere in the 2000s, and I was traveling with two of my siblings on the Megabus. It was a night trip, and we were waiting in line to board the bus. We were in the middle of the line, and a few feet away from the middle of the bus were the bus driver, an older African-American man, above 70 years old. Oh, I know, I fucking read that wrong. We were in the middle of the line and a few feet away from the middle of the bus, where the bus driver, an older African-American man above 70 years old, was loading suitcases onto the bus. Just about all the passengers had arrived, and we were in line waiting to board when a Caucasian mother and child arrived and approached the bus driver. The driver begins asking questions about destination, and one thing leads to another. I don't exactly remember what was said, but turns out the mother only purchased a ticket for her child. Unbeknownst to the mother, her child was too young to travel alone, according to Megabus rules. The driver politely tells her that her child could not travel alone, and he refuses to load the child's suitcase. That's when an argument ensues between the mother and bus driver.
The driver continues to politely explain that he cannot allow the child to board, but the mother refuses to listen. Eventually, the driver realizes that the mother isn't going to give in, so he throws up his hands in frustration and turns around to start letting passengers board the bus. The mother then throws her hot coffee onto the driver while at the same time calling him the N-word and then storms off. Mouths drop open and everyone goes silent. Actually, I'm pretty sure everyone was silent while this was going on. So you may be thinking, oh, maybe her coffee was cold. Nope. The cold air revealed that the coffee was hot. Steam from the hot liquid rose from the driver's drenched dark blue uniform. Wow, is that an image? Do you remember how you felt when it happened? I was in total shock. The way the N-word flew out of her mouth with such ease and no remorse. She definitely used that word often. I wonder if the driver was white, would she have thrown the coffee and called him a derogatory term. I don't know if she realized that there were black people in line when she said it, but she obviously had no care about who heard her. How do you feel about it now? It saddens me. When it happened, none of the passengers who witnessed it consoled the driver or said anything about it to him. Everyone, including myself, just pretended it didn't happen, and I regret not doing anything. At the time, though, I was in my teens and was suffering from really bad social anxiety, so the thought of trying to console a stranger was something that gave me anxiety. What a great example, too, of the secondary ripples of painful shit. You know, first of all, that woman probably had no idea how she affected the bus driver. So wrapped up in her own fucking narcissistic bullshit, but I'm absolutely sure she had no idea that she would leave memories of the people who witnessed that that are painful and uncomfortable to remember. Any thoughts or feelings that you'd like to share? That event was burned in my brain because that man was definitely old enough to have lived through the civil rights era. So to still experience something like this in the 2000s solidified in my mind that there is still so much more that needs to be done. Not only that, but for an African American, it feels impossible distinguishing whether negative actions against you are due to your skin color or for some other random reason. Whether treatment towards you would have been different if you weren't a person of color. Things like that run through my mind on a daily basis. It's draining and takes away from my 3-volt social battery. Oh, do I love that phrase. 3-volt social battery. It also causes me to avoid putting myself in situations that might lead me to interacting with someone who displays racist tendencies. Anywho, love the podcast. It helped me get through my most recent episode of depression. Whenever someone I know is in a tough spot, I always try to get them to listen to this podcast. Thanks for what you do and for your support of people of color. Well, that means a lot to me, and I appreciate you. I appreciate you sharing that. And God, that's so... The vignettes that you guys paint with the surveys are like little movies sometimes. This is from the love survey filled out by a person who calls himself, "Well, piss on a pancake and call me Mildred." Is that a thing? Is that a phrase? Their love, "I love walking around my apartment naked except for my giant, ridiculous, puffy, comfy slippers." Speaking of images, sometimes when I'm cooking for my girlfriend, I will wear nothing but an apron, and we both laugh. This is from the Shame and Secrets survey, and this is filled out by Miriam. She is straight, in her 40s, was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment, was sexually abused and reported it. "I was sexually, physically, and emotionally abused for years daily by my stepfather from ages 11 to 16, and emotionally and physically abused by my mother from birth until age 16. There was also some other sexual abuse by other people close to her. When I was 16,
16-something years old, I ran away from home. The social worker and authorities were doubtful of my report. That was 30 years ago. It led to reinforced trauma. 30 years after the, quote, escape, I'm able to live a mostly meaningful life. It is not that I am necessarily happy every day, but I am okay enough. Healing happened through my own efforts to heal, through time, and through the therapeutic relationship with the therapist who ultimately helped me to heal what was broken because of the abuse that led to multiple personalities. Healing is an ongoing effort. There are days when something triggers PTSD and I have to deal with it. I'm still not able to feel and experience a full spectrum of emotions, but I am okay enough. I can hold a full-time job, went back to school, and now also hold a master's degree. I have a family of my own. How do I feel about it today? I will never forgive the people who abused me. There is no right to be forgiven or to even ask for that. I do not have contact with any abusers. For the longest time, I could not talk about what happened to me, never mind having words. It's a miracle that I'm doing as well as I am, and I thank the divine power every day. Any positive experiences with abusers? No positive experiences. I was forced to have orgasms, which led to a lot of guilt until I became able to understand the physical reaction and how everything ties into the abuse. Yeah, it is such a mind fuck that your soul can experience something completely different from your body at the same time. Darkest thoughts. I have sexual fantasies that are close to what happened to me. So often, they arouse me, which makes me feel ashamed at times. I understand it is a way of exercising control, but still. Darkest secrets. After years of abuse and conditioning to react in sexual ways, I had an orgasm with anal rape. I want my husband to have anal sex with me, which he does not wish to do. I got adult toys to deal with my desire. What are the sexual fantasies most powerful to you? I have fantasies of being helpless, tied up, and forced orgasm, including pain/BDSM. In my fantasies, I am in control and willingly endure with pleasure, which was different back when it happened to me. And that's such an important distinction, too, and highlights the complexity of the relationship between past trauma and present-day sexual pleasure. What, if anything, do you wish for? I wish to make a positive difference in other people's lives. Have you shared these things with others? I shared some with my therapist when I was in therapy. Not everything, though. There are things that will most likely stay unspoken because they are too horrific to talk about. How do you feel after writing these things down? Good. Wow, thank you for that. And I'm so glad that you're in a better place. That is a lot of shit to heal from. And, you know, I was talking with somebody the other day, and it occurred to me that we can be doing well while at the same time not feel like we're doing well. Just kind of like we can be feeling like we're doing well and actually not doing well. You know, for instance, if we're on a 3-day binge of cocaine and we feel like we can take on the world, but, you know, in reality, we're on our way of burning our life to the ground. But especially with healing and working through trauma, you know, it's an overall forward movement, but sometimes it's like, it's so painful. It's hard to put into words, yet it's something positive that we're doing and we're doing well and that we're moving forward, but we feel like shit while we're doing it. This is from the love survey filled out by anyone else find this bit hard. And they write, I love the gentle humming noise my 3-year-old daughter has always made when she eats something she absolutely loves. Like there's nothing else to ever think about but that delicious spoonful of ice cream she has right now. I love when shower gels are on sale and buying loads of flavors. Then, because I'm an adult and could do whatever the hell I want with my shower gels, opening every one and keeping them all in the shower opened. Then using different scents on different parts of my body and having an awesome long shower that feels like a 7-course meal.
I love that feeling after a spell of anxiety passes and suddenly the world is still and everything is no longer a threat. You see colors again and can actually appreciate the beauty in the world instead of just seeing danger everywhere. And I love when you really don't want to do something you've committed to, but you don't want to be a jerk and cancel, but then your friend cancels so you can just not do the thing and not feel guilty, and can instead just take a massive, long, 7-course meal shower. That is awesome. That is awesome. How do you find room for all of that in your... I am always tripping over shit, soap and shower gel on the rim of my bathtub when I get in for a shower. And then finally, this is an awfulsome moment filled by AIM in Minnesota. And she writes, my grandfather died last October. He was old and more than ready to die. Nevertheless, the 6 a.m. phone call and subsequent rushed drive to his nursing home, only to find my parents in tears and a dead body, was emotionally difficult. He used to be large, imposing. He would stab us with forks if we burped at the table. I sat on the edge of his bed, his somehow smaller body still in that awful way that means there is no breath, no heartbeat, and leaned down to lay my head on his chest and give him one last hug. The pressure from my arms and the weight of my body forced leftover air and gas out of his body, causing a burp to come out of his mouth. And that is the image I wanted to leave you with. Ah, thank you for sharing that, Amy. I don't know what to say, man. Fucking hang in there. Hang in there. The one constant in the universe is that shit changes. And I'm glad I hung around. Even if I'm sleeping more than dead people. Just remember, you're not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up
I know
in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully
everybody
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.